all of their feet. And he knows that he's about to betray him. I think that's amazing that he did that. All right. This next section. I say that I called this complacency, but Jesus is showing a lot of fervor. Well, the disciples are showing some complacency. I actually want to read just part of this text. Jason, do you want to read 27 to 31?
Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise.
All right. Notice again, in this last section, you see that Jesus had foreknowledge of where the meal would be and the guy that was walking with the jug, and then also foreknowledge of betrayal. In this section, you also have Jesus' foreknowledge of the disciples deserting him. This is ironic because I think it's the last verse of this chapter. Mark 14... No, 1465. Notice in 1465 when Jesus starts to get mistreated, it says, "And some began to spit on him and cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, 'Prophesy.' And the guards received him with blows." When they're saying prophesy, I think they've covered his head and they're saying, "Okay, who struck you? Who struck you? Prophesy, tell us." And what's he been doing all throughout this section? Prophesying. And so I think that's ironic why there's so much foreknowledge that Jesus has in this text. He first of all says in verses 27 and 28, all the disciples are going to flee. And then Peter says, "Well, I'm not going to. I wouldn't be surprised if they do, but I'm not going to." And Jesus says to Peter in particular, "You will too." Now, the word complacency is related to the terms comfort and place. What is complacency? It's where you're comfortable with the place that you're at. And so Peter here thinks that he's more zealous than he really is. He feels pretty good about himself. But when Jesus is even just praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, what happens to them? They're falling asleep. They're not watching and praying like Jesus said. We'll talk more about that in just a second, but I want to ask this question here. In the Garden of Gethsemane, did God answer Jesus' prayer? Now, all right, let me explain why this is a confusing question. Because in Hebrews 5:7, it talks about how in the days of his flesh he offered up prayers and God heard him because of his reverence. And it sure sounds like in Hebrews chapter 5, it's talking about the Garden of Gethsemane. So, if God heard Jesus' prayers, in the sense that he answered them, it seems, in Hebrews chapter 5, was there any sense in which Jesus' prayer in the garden was answered? In what way? Okay, good. Jesus' prayer wasn't just, "Don't make me go, don't make me do." It was, "Your will be done." And so did God answer that prayer? God's will was done. I will say also, in Luke 22:43, it's only mentioned in Luke. It's one of those things that it's easy to pass by real quickly. But while Jesus was making this prayer, God did send an angel that strengthened him. And so even though Jesus' request to let the cup pass, that wasn't answered in that kind of way, God did send help for him while he was making this prayer. And so I think that's worth saying. Jesus does say in John 18:11 that he does have to drink the cup when he gets arrested. All right, anything you guys want to say up to that point? Yeah. Right. This is a good point. Jesus, when he begins his prayers, he's sorrowful, he's at the point of death, he's sweating his drops of blood in the Gospel of Luke. And then in John 18, 1 through 11, when he gets arrested, he boldly stands up to them and he says, "Whom do you seek?" And what happens to the army, the soldiers? they all fall back. And like you imagine there's probably an awkward silence there for a moment, and you can hear all of them like trying to pick themselves back up. And Jesus is able to boldly go before. He seems very different. What changed? Well, I think the angel strengthened him. I think him communing with the Father in prayer gave him a kind of boldness for that moment that he may not have had if he wasn't praying. So, I think that's a good point to bring up. All right. Notice then the fulfillments here. In 43 to 52, here comes Judas, and he betrays Jesus with the kiss. It identifies who he is for the people. And Peter is ready to kill somebody. He slices his ear off. I was in fencing for a few years, and it's like moving a sword can be, get kind of tricky. If I was to just try to slice off somebody's ear, that would have been really hard. So I think either the guy like moved like this and Peter was going for the head and got the ear, or stumbled or whatever. I don't know. I think he was going for his head. And so he's ready to kill. Now just keep that in mind for when we get later in this chapter. So Judas betrays Jesus, and then the disciples all desert Jesus. Look at verses 50 to 52. I'll go ahead and read those. And they all left him and fled, and a young man followed him, and with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away. All right. What is up with that story? So the disciples all flee, and then we kind of narrow in on this one guy that becomes naked. What was that, Ken? Yeah, there's a lot of people that think that was Mark, because in Acts chapter 12, Mark's mother had a house in this area, it seems. And so maybe he was out there, and that's why he was like in a nightgown or something like that to see what was going on. That's possible. Any other ideas? Yeah, there's a sense in which what happens to him physically is sort of what's metaphorically happening to the disciples. Because nakedness in the Bible is a shameful thing after the fall. And so, can you imagine, like, don't imagine it, but like, here, they grab this guy's robe, and then, like, if you're naked, like, you don't want to be running in front of everybody, but he's so scared in the moment that he's willing to be shamed in that way, and keep running without any clothes. I think this emphasizes how scary this moment would have been for the disciples and their unwillingness to stand up with Jesus. Can you imagine your best friends turning their back on you and they're so scared of the moment that they're even willing to run naked to get away from you, from the situation? So I think that's maybe part of what's going on there. Any other things you guys want to say about that story? Okay, so in Amos 2, it talks about like brave warriors fleeing naked. Okay, good. Okay, good. Yes, sir. Right. Yeah, Mark is done, and that might be evidence that it is Mark kind of saying, I was there, but I don't want to say that it was me, but I was there. Christy? Say that again? Yeah, Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Yeah, like, in that case, Joseph is running in a righteous kind of way, but this guy is doing it for the opposite reason. So there's a contrast there, maybe. Anything else about that? All right, I want to slow down then, and with the time that we have, talk about the trials. Now, this chart is going to be online on the PowerPoint thing, but there's a couple things about the trials of Jesus that I learned while... shortly before we left California, I had tried to figure out, looking at all the Gospels, how many trials did Jesus actually go through and everything, and I put this together to try to help me figure it out. But you see, on this chart, Jesus went through 6 total trials. When you put all the Gospels together, he had 6 trials. The first 3 of them were with Jewish people, and then the last 3 were with the Romans. Well, why the Jews first? Well, because they had to find out amongst themselves, how can we get this guy crucified? And then who has the right to crucify? The Romans. So you have to go through the Jews first for them to be able to sanction this, and then they go plead with the Romans to make this happen. And so the first trial of Jesus was with Annas, who was the former high priest. That's recorded in John, you know, after Jesus stands up and all the army falls down and they're all scared and everything like that. They take Jesus to Annas, who's not the current high priest, but I think they're trying to get his input on the situation. Then they take him to Caiaphas, which is the next section that we're going to look at here in Mark. So this, what we see in Mark, the way that Mark portrays this, is that the first trial that Mark records is actually the second one that Jesus went through. All right? The third one is with the Sanhedrin. Mark 15:1 kind of alludes to it, but it doesn't record everything that happened there. And then after that, you get into the Roman ones with Pilate, which the Gospel of Mark shows you the first trial with Pilate. But then remember in the Gospel of Luke that Pilate passes him on, passes him on to Herod, and then Herod passes him back to Luke. Or Herod passes him back to, who was it? Pilate, that guy. So the way that it's recorded in Mark is that in chapter 15, 1 through 15, it looks like it's all one trial, but it actually is getting interrupted in the text. So if that thing can go away, then maybe I can show you a couple other things on this. Can I? Oh, they did it. All right. Notice something else about this. In all of these trials, there are some kind of injustices happening to Jesus. In other words, the Romans or the Jews are breaking laws in one way or another. Now, I'll talk more about that in just a moment, but that's important to highlight here. Any comments or questions before we move on from this? All right, then let's look at, we're not going to read this first part here. Now, this isn't working. I don't know what's going on. All right, well, the Sanhedrin trial that Jesus goes through in 53 through 72, this is a trial that the Jews, you see them not really thinking very straight throughout this trial. Because if you look, for example, at verse 55, look at Mark 14, verse 55. It says, "Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none." All right, so here's the trial. What is it that they're seeking to do in this trial? They're seeking to put him to death. All right, here we go. And so does that show you that they're starting with the right motives? They're seeking. They're actively trying to figure out not what the truth is, but they're trying to figure out how is it that we can actually get this guy killed. And when Jesus does confess that he is the Christ, what does the high priest do with his clothes? He tears them. Was that against the law for the high priest? Leviticus 21, verse 10, the high priest was specifically told, don't tear your clothes. All right. Do you think that these Jewish priests, these Jewish leaders, do you think that they ordinarily would have been people of pretty good judgment about things? Were they the educated, smart people that should have known right and wrong? Let me suggest that the way that Jesus gets treated in these trials is a great lesson today that people who are highly intelligent, people who are really smart, become dumb with Jesus. And I'm using the word dumb in the technical sense. You can have college professors who know a lot of stuff, they're really smart. Ordinarily, they might have sound judgment on a lot of things. But then you put Jesus in front of them, and it seems like all of their reasoning capacities go out the window. I remember when I was in college thinking, being really intimidated by the professors who had a lot of great reasoning, it seemed. But then whenever they started talking about Jesus and the Bible, it seemed like they were not being very reasonable at all, but they were reasonable seemingly about everything else. And so this is one of the effects that Jesus has on these people as he's before them. And ironically, when he confesses to be the Christ, they say that he's committing blasphemy. But in what they're doing to Jesus, they're the ones that are actually committing blasphemy. So they're blinded in all of this. And we already talked about the command for Jesus to prophesy here. But anything you guys want to say just about how they interact with Jesus and treat him and how that might look today? Yeah, Mimi? Right, yeah. They were not saying, okay, let's figure out if Jesus is who he said he was. They started from the beginning, I want to disprove this. There's a lot of people today, it could be even a particular doctrine that you don't like that the Bible says it, but you're automatically going to passages trying to disprove that doctrine. That doesn't show a good heart. A good heart, what's supposed to happen in the court of law is that you figure out the information and then make a decision. But in this case, they're already trying to make, trying to prove what they want to prove. I saw a hand over here. No. All right. Blaine? Right. Good. And we're going to see in 15, chapter 15, why they're so zealous about getting him crucified. But while Jesus is on trial, Peter's also on trial, but it's an unofficial trial. Because Peter is outside and he's warming himself by the fire. By the way, anybody know what kind of fire it was that he was warming himself by? It was a charcoal fire. All right. Why does that matter? Because in the Gospel of John is the one that tells us this. Peter denies Jesus three times by a charcoal fire, and when Peter gets reinstated, where is he? You know what you're supposed to say now. By a charcoal fire. He was on the beach, and Jesus had cooked breakfast for them, and he had cooked it around a charcoal fire, and then here's Jesus asking him three times, do you love me, do you love me, do you love me? Peter fell asleep three times in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then that's followed up by three denials, and then Jesus reinstates him three times with the same kind of scent coming into Peter's nose in the same kind of place that he denied him. And so I think that's an interesting thing. But one thing I want to point out about Peter's denial, was he just willing to kill somebody? He was willing to take a sword, but now Jesus has been arrested, and who is Peter denying Jesus in front of? A little servant girl. I don't know how old she was, 11, 12, I don't know. But she's asking, hey, I think you're one of those people. And he said, no. How can he, on the one hand, be so bold and willing to kill somebody with a sword, and then when a slave girl is talking to him, he denies Jesus? How do you reconcile those things? He's all alone? What else? Yeah, Steve? Right. Yeah. Teresa? Yeah, I mean, after he denies Jesus one time, is it easier to deny him a second time? Like, how do you backtrack after you've done it once? But I think, like, his defenses have been broken down. And remember what Jesus did with the soldier that he cut the ear off? What did he do with him? Put the ear back on. I wonder if that was a big turning point for Peter when he saw him do that. But either way, the rooster crows, the rooster's communicating to Peter. Balaam's donkey helped Balaam. Jonah had the worm. Here, Jesus had predicted that the rooster was going to crow when all of this was happening, and he weeps bitterly and knows what's happening with that. Now, one thing that's ironic about what's happening here is that while Jesus is on trial, at the same time Peter is denying Jesus, Jesus is confessing who he is to save us. Well, by way of contrast, Peter's denying his identity to save himself. So, you see Jesus' love for even people that are denying him at the very moment. All right. Anything else you want to say about that? All right. I really wanted to get to this. So, Jason, do you want to read 15:1-15?
Immediately in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus, led him away, and delivered him to Pilate. And then Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered and said to him, "It is as you say." And the chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. Then Pilate asked him again, saying, "Do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you." But Jesus still answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. Now at the feast he was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whoever they requested. And there was one named Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow rebels. They had committed murder in the rebellion. Then the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do just as he had always done for them. But Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he would rather release Barabbas to them. Pilate answered and said to them again, "What do you want me to do with him who you call the King of the Jews?" So they cried out again, "Crucify him." Then Pilate said to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him to be crucified.
All right, I just want to focus on one thing in these 15 verses. What are the reasons Jesus was crucified? I think I asked that question in the material. What do you guys find as, how does this text help us see why Jesus was ultimately delivered over to be crucified? Grady? Okay, good, that's... Okay, good, what else? Yeah, Chuck? From the Jewish perspective of this, like from the Jews, why they were so zealous to get Jesus crucified and they were seeking to get him to be killed, if you were to ask them, hey, what's really going on in your heart right now? They wouldn't have just said, well, it's envy. They were trying to paint Jesus as this really terrible rabble-rouser kind of guy, but even Pilate recognizes here that it's because of envy that they're doing that. Well, why were they envious? They had lost their following. Remember when Jesus had walked into Jerusalem with the triumphal entry? What was everybody doing? They were all excited about his entrance. Can you imagine the chief priests and the scribes kind of standing off to the side? And maybe some of them came in right before Jesus and were like, oh, hey, good to see you, Rabbi. And then here comes Jesus and everybody's really excited. They've been stirred up by this. And one lesson I think to learn from this is that when we refuse to give Jesus the glory and the fame, we're committing the same sin. Because who is it that deserves to be famous? If we can just use that term. Jesus does. Well, how often do we want to be the ones that are that way? And because that's their heart, they're kind of marginalizing him and doing more than that, trying to kill him and put him to the margins in that way. So that's the first reason Jesus gets crucified. Yeah. Yeah, they were losing a lot of money too after what Jesus did in the temple. I mean, maybe they set it back up again, but yeah, that wasn't good for business. Here's another reason why Jesus gets crucified. It's because of Pilate's fear of man. It's amazing that Pilate can read, well, that you guys are wanting to do this because you're envious. And then in verse 15, the text says that Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, he even asks the question, what evil has he done? Why is Pilate caving? He's supposed to be a man of justice. He works at this Roman outpost where he was supposed to uphold righteous judgments. Yeah. That's right. If his territory is always rioting, I mean, maybe it would be better for this one man to die so that the nation doesn't do all of these kinds of things. But you see that his fear of what people think about him made him lose his integrity. And that's another lesson for us. If we're overly concerned about what people think about us, just like the Jewish leaders, our reasoning faculties go out the window. Steve? Right, that's right. Yeah. I'll give one other reason why Jesus is crucified here. I think once Barabbas was released, that was like the last opportunity for Pilate to try to get Jesus released. Barabbas gets released instead of Jesus. What does the name Barabbas mean? So like Simon, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but the Father is... Okay, why is Simon called Simon Bar-Jonah? What's Bar? Son of. All right, what's Abba? Son of the Father. So this guy, his name is Son of the Father. And who really is the Son of the Father in this text? Jesus is. And so Jesus, like 1 Peter 3:18 says, that Jesus was the righteous one who suffered for the unrighteous. When this guy gets released, and it's not Jesus, that sort of seals his fate in that kind of way. So those are the reasons that I see Jesus being handed over. He gets handed over, and then in verse 15, he gets scourged. Now, there's some people that have confused scourging with the 40 lashes. Paul in 2 Corinthians says that I had 40 lashes minus one, or I had 39 lashes. The Old Testament said to do 40 lashes, but they got so conscientious and so worried that they might do more than 40. So they took one away and said, we'll do 39, because the law says we can do 40. But just in case we do more, then like we're breaking the law. So that's why they did 39. This is a Roman scourging. This is not a Jewish thing. So when Paul talks about the 40 lashes, the 39 lashes, that's not what's happening to Jesus here. The Romans were more severe than the Jews. A lot of people would actually die just from the scourging. So when you see that Jesus was scourged, don't confuse that with the 40 lashes. This is a Roman thing, not a Jewish thing. Grady? That's true. Good point. All right, I guess that's our time. Sorry, we did have to go through this one a little bit faster. There's some things I wish we could have slowed down more for, but on Sunday, we'll look at his death, burial, and resurrection.